You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn. And you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hosts. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethosts.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Margie, and welcome to the Desert Island Dishes podcast. This is the podcast where every week I ask my guests to choose their 7 Desert Island dishes. These range from finding out about the dish that most reminds them of their childhood, the best dish they've ever eaten, and of course, the last dish they would choose to eat before being cast off to the desert island. I hope you're all well. Thank you so much for the lovely emails and Instagram messages you've been sending me about the podcast. I genuinely can't tell you how nice it is to know that so many of you are listening and enjoying it. It's honestly the best feeling, so thank you. Despite risking sounding like a broken record, can I ask you to leave a 5-star rating on iTunes and a little sentence about why you like it, as it really is a big help. I'm sure many of you will already follow this week's guest, and Ed had a dramatic career change, and I think this might be a good one for anyone who's ever thought about changing jobs and following their passion, whether that's into the world of food or not. But yeah, I hope you enjoy. My guest today is Ed Smith. You may know him by his pen name, Rocket and Squash. Ed gave up a high-flying career in law around 6 years ago to pursue a career in food. He is the author of the hugely popular and award-winning website, Rocket and Squash, which is sort of a smorgasbord of delicious things from recipes to restaurant reviews and cookery news. He has now written 2 cookbooks to much acclaim and regularly writes for a multitude of publications. In 2015, Fortnum & Mason Food and Drink Awards named him Best Online Restaurant Writer and shortlisted him for Best Cookery Writer, which is pretty impressive. Welcome, Ed.
Thank you very much.
So you were working as a corporate lawyer, working at Freshfields until 2012. Tell me, did you grow up dreaming of becoming a lawyer, or was it one of those jobs where there was sort of a straightforward but by no means easy career path?
My mum was a solicitor, and she specifically told me not to be one.
Okay.
When I started thinking about it, but if I ever went, put my head back to career development chats at school and stuff, it's one of a handful of professions that came to mind, partly because mum was one. You know, what else do you do apart from what your parents?
Sure.
What do you know apart from what your parents do? And yeah, I did quite well at school and well at university, and it just became an obvious career route. And one of the good things about law, which is a great career for those people that love the subject matter, is that there's this obvious career in there. You know, you work as a trainee and then you become a qualified lawyer, and you work up and up, and then hopefully become a partner. That's what you expect. And I think I like to think I'm relatively creative in some things, but I'm also massively risk averse.
Oh, really?
Others. And so that's probably why law stood out to me, and rather than a bit more a left field career choice.
also it's one of those things at university, you can see you either study it as a degree or you do a master's, and a sort of, yeah, there's a path that you can follow. Whereas lots of other careers are sort of, how on earth do you get started?
Exactly. Yeah. It's I think I wonder whether it's changed now. If I was sort of 20 years younger and people coming out of university now are a bit more ambitious to their own thing, and social media makes people think they can achieve anything rather than go on a career ladder like I did, perhaps it would have been different. I don't know, idea.
Yeah, that's so true. There have been such big changes. I wonder whether traditional paths are actually being overlooked now in view of other things.
Maybe. I think, and also I think that if I was younger, whether it was 18 or 21 or 23, I might have made, at that age now, I think I might have decided I wanted a career in food at that point.
Oh, do you
in
think?
A way that I didn't back in 2000 or whenever it was that I made that.
Yeah. These
career choices. I feel like it feels like more of a legit career now.
Yeah, that's a good point.
That whole rock star chef thing, people in the press, food is a really interesting topic for a lot of people. And that's one of the reasons why I made a career change, I'm sure. And maybe it would have been on my mind younger as well.
Also, I was very impressed when I was sort of researching you, because I think it's quite gutsy to be working as a lawyer and then, you know, have the salary, and sort of not in a blatantly materialistic way, but sort of you have the trappings of what that salary brings to your life. And so to walk away from that, I think, is quite brave.
Yeah. I mean, I think at the time I probably thought I wasn't walking away completely from having the salary. In fact, I know for a fact that I just assumed that a couple of years later I'd be, you know, earning the same sort of decent thing. And it's,
didn't we all, Ed?
Yeah, I know. It's a shame, isn't it? But actually, I think what it did was, having worked for 5 or 6 years and at the time not having any responsibilities, it gave me the freedom to say, I'm going to take a bit of time, reassess what I want from my personal life and from my professional life, and jump in. And it was quite a risky move. It was also, I've said that I'm risk averse.
Yeah.
I am quite risk averse, and it was quite a big move, but there were some soft padding underneath, I think.
Okay. And we're going to hear about that in a bit, but let's pause there and talk about the first desert island dish. And that's the dish that most reminds you of your childhood.
So I found actually thinking about a lot of things quite difficult, because there are so many answers that you can give to everything.
Yeah.
Actually, my mum and dad have been staying with us, or in London, the last few days, seeing our son. And I asked mum to cook something on Monday night. I did buy her the ingredients.
Okay.
But it did suddenly firm up that actually spaghetti bolognese is this exactly this kind of dish that reminds me of my youth. It wasn't something we had all the time, but there were iterations of it, you know, chili con carne in the classic sort of spag bol plus red kidney bean and a bit of chili powder way, shepherd's pie, cottage pie, all these things that basically start with a 1980s spag bol. And it does remind me of home. And mum actually standing in our kitchen cooking that was quite, it firmed up my response to this, because it's like, yeah, that reminds me of a youth.
Yeah, that's a good one. Does she have a special recipe?
I love it when you listen to podcasts and see TV programs and people talk about sitting on their nonna's knee,
you know,
podding peas and stuff. And mum's a great cook and a great entertainer. But I had a very kind of Delia Smith upbringing, I think, and Jocelyn Dimbleby. Those were the kind of books that she read. They were how to put on stuff for friends and simple, normal food for normal people in the 80s.
Yeah.
And so spag bol was not an Italian ragu. You know, it was whatever dried herb was in the cupboard, and some mince and some tomato puree and maybe some tinned tomatoes.
It was how Delia said.
Probably. Well, just how things have happened and evolved. And I think that it also is a dish that I enjoy doing now, but adding embellishments that take it away from that initial stage and make it a little bit refined isn't the right word, because that is, it's just a nice family meal, isn't it?
Yeah. Can it ever be refined? But if anyone could do that, I reckon you're the man for the job.
Thanks very much.
I wondered, when you had the realization that what you and most lawyers were working towards is to become partner, and you realized that wasn't what you wanted, did that realization come from the job not being something that you were fully passionate about? Or was it the life of a partner at a law firm that you realized wasn't for you?
I think it's a combination of, this is like sitting on a psychiatrist.
Yeah.
I think it was a combination of realizing not just that I didn't want to be a partner, but I didn't want to be someone working towards partnership. It's an incredibly difficult thing in a city firm. You really give up your life for a while, if not ever. And I just sort of came to realize I didn't want to do that. And when that's quite a strange feeling, because I'd always wanted to be someone who had achieved, you know, whatever profession I'm in. But at the same time, I sort of came to realization that I did want to do well at whatever I did, and that whatever you do, you have to work hard. So it wasn't a question of not working hard. Maybe it's the subject matter that you're working on needed to change. And about 2 years before I left law, I had started writing Rocket and Squash as a creative outlet.
Okay.
And I definitely wasn't doing it to change profession. I was doing it to make sure that I cooked every week and I went to restaurants every week, because that's what I enjoyed doing, and I wasn't doing it. And being slightly OCD, I needed that thing to make that happen. But I think what it made me realize was that there was a different industry or a different subject matter that maybe I should try to turn my working life to.
Yeah, so that's such a good point. You're not afraid of hard work, and it's nothing to do with that. It's just, if you're going to be working that hard, it might as well be towards something that you're
sort of, and there's a whole load of things. Most of my friends are still lawyers, and I don't see anything wrong with that if they enjoy what they're doing.
Yeah.
And I just didn't want to spend my life doing financial regulatory reviews. And
what, they sound so interesting.
They're a lot of fun for some people. But it's a service industry. It's a service industry for people with very high demands. And I think that just sort of made me wonder whether there's something I could do that's a bit more creative.
Yeah. And that dreaded phrase, work-life balance. I wondered, working for yourself, do you find that you're actually working as much as you work?
Oh, I mean, that's the thing, is I'm almost certainly working as hard, if not harder, than I ever worked in my 70-hour weeks as a corporate lawyer. Like I haven't had a weekend for a long time, partly because I dug my own grave with doing something that involved reviewing the weekend papers for a blog post every Monday. But also just because when you're self-employed, you are your accounts office, your HR, your PR department, and everything else in between. You can never really stop working. And my nature is that I can't really switch off thinking what else I could be doing.
Yeah, it's
when in fact stressful. I should be having a holiday or a weekend. So I failed.
No, we won't phrase it like that. Let's talk about the second desert island dish. And that's the first dish that you learned to cook.
Which could probably have been spaghetti bolognese as well. But no, I think actually I couldn't tell you the very first dish I cooked or, you know, what I helped mum with first. But I'm one of four boys, and I realized at quite an early age that if I helped mum with the Sunday lunch, I didn't have to set the table, I didn't have to do the washing up. So that's why I gravitated towards the stove.
It's a good reason.
And I suspect that as well as helping mum, you know, occasionally make crumbles or whatever the pudding was, I'm pretty certain I took control of gravy early on.
I mean, that's a key component.
It is. It's essential to a good roast.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think, you know, when I say the first thing I ever made, initially that would have been, you know, mum's way was a bit of bisto and the boiling water from the carrots or something like that. But I think that it sort of, I evolved that over time and taught myself how to make gravy with flour and the stock from the chicken and evolved it after reading books and watching TV. And by then I'm sure I've cooked lots of other things, but the gravy thing was always my role, I think, and really quite a small effort comparative to having to do the washing up.
Yeah, and it's one of those things that's kind of a small effort but big reward in terms of everyone always talks about the gravy,
Exactly.
So as you said, you started your blog when you were still working as a lawyer, and I love that you say that you first wrote it anonymously. Tell us a bit more about that.
Yeah, well, I started writing it when I was, I think I must have qualified as a solicitor. So I've been at the firm for a few years already and, you know, and technically grown up, you know, and I just felt that this was in the peak age of restaurant blogging in London. It's sort of 2009, 2010. All the newspaper critics were really worried about these people writing online, taking their jobs and their influence. All the restaurants were jumping on bloggers as this really important thing without really knowing who was reading it, if anyone was reading it. But it was, for a certain section of people, quite an interesting media. And I think for whatever reason, I thought, I'm not going to put my name on it. I didn't really want anyone at work to know that I was doing that, as if anyone would be reading it. I mean,
they may have been.
But I just thought anonymity was one thing that was a, appropriate. And also, I think that many people who have blogs, and now that's probably Instagram, are kind of, and I count myself in this, kind of introverted extroverts.
Okay.
So, of course, there are people who want to promote themselves from day one. But I think a lot of people are able to sit behind a laptop or a phone and project a version of themselves that maybe they have never been quite so comfortable with in person.
I'm
sure that was one of the reasons why I was anonymous as well. I like to think I've got an opinion, but I'm not going to stand on a stage and shout it without people telling me they want to hear it already. And I think that's quite
a scary thing to do, isn't it? Because it could be embarrassing and go wrong.
Yeah, I think there's an element of not. Of just what there's a safety behind a computer screen or a phone that means that people can be something slightly different to what they're used to being in normal life.
Definitely. And I guess the written word, you can, yeah, be a version of yourself.
I was relatively unusual as a 28-year-old man.
Okay.
Blogging about food in 2010. I think I'm right in saying that the majority of people around then were female doing that, and I was maybe conscious of that. I don't know why, but certainly when I came out and put my name on the on the blog, a number of people were very surprised that I was male
because of how you'd written it, or just merely by the fact that you had a blog.
I think a bit of everything. There's an assumption, but I think mostly an assumption that someone who's got a blog that's named after two vegetables, that's all white and quite calm, that is a food blog full stop, is possibly female. I mean, there were plenty of opportunities had they read all my stuff to find out that I was male. I was not that anonymous. It was interesting that was a reaction of a lot of people, either that they thought that I was a lot older or female.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I don't really know what to say about that.
I know. I don't think it means anything. I don't think it means anything at all, but it's linked to the anonymity.
So you did leave your job and you went to study at Westminster Catering College for 6 months. Was it important to you to get some proper training, or was it more a bit of a chance to get some breathing space and figure out what your next move would be?
Both of those things. I think that I intended to write a business plan whilst at Catering College, and I was like, yeah, I'm going to start a scalable food business, sell it for £50 million in 4 years' time. And I'm just going to write that business plan now because I haven't had a chance to do that whilst working. Obviously, that didn't happen. I also was wondering what part of the food industry I wanted to work in, whether it was a restaurateur or a chef or a cookery school owner or things like that. And I felt that having a good grounding in classical food without having to do that, either working from the bottom up in the restaurant or just starting out on my own, this was in many ways a safety pad and a chance to just try a few things.
Yeah. Because as you say, deciding that you want to do something in food is quite a broad bracket.
Oh, yeah.
And it's sort of the first step. But then as you say, what are you actually going to do within
that? And in a way, it was me painting over the fact that I hadn't really decided what I wanted to do. Sure. It's like, hey, mum, look, I'm leaving my job and I'm going to catering college. I've made that firm decision. But it didn't actually mean that I knew what I was going to do. I still don't know what I'm going
to
do.
Yeah, no, it's a very useful tool to be able to tell other people you're doing it. I just remember at cookery school having this sort of dawning realization that maybe that was how I was meant to feel whilst I was doing my actual degree, where I was sort of excited every morning to learn what they were going to teach me.
Yeah, nice.
That is not how I felt at university. So let's move on to the third desert island dish. And that's the best dish that you've ever eaten.
I found this really hard. I think I've got a good memory, but I think I eat a lot of good food. And I don't think that I can identify a single dish or even meal that was like the best moment. There are a few like highlights, and they often come to thinking about it. They're often from traveling abroad or going to restaurants abroad on specific kind of foodie pilgrimages. There's a whole baked celeriac dish at this place called Daniel Berlin in Skåne, which is in southern Sweden, which was amazing. But it wasn't the best thing I've ever tasted. And actually, I'm not sure that the best thing I've ever tasted isn't in Britain. And I was thinking about it more that in the last few years, I've definitely had some incredible pieces of meat, like aged beef cooked over flames and just cooked to perfection, the taste of the most bovine thing you can imagine, and grass and all the smoke and everything else in between, and the marbling's amazing. And it's that kind of thing that I think sticks out now. And based in Cornwall, called Coombs Head Farm, which is brilliant. And Tommy Adams there raises his own pigs. And I remember having a Mangalitsa, which is a breed of pig loin, which was unlike any other pork I've had before. And so it's that kind of thing. Also cured meats. Like I could sit eating ham on from Spain, wherever you have it, whether it's in a restaurant or a market. It's that kind of thing is memorable.
Yeah, I actually saw you post some mortadella earlier on your Instagram.
I actually have some good meats here if you'd like some.
So you say that back in the back of your mind, you thought maybe you would start a product-based food business. If you were going back in time, is there anything that you would do differently?
What, in life generally or about food?
Sorry, that was quite a general question. When you left your legal job and you embarked on this new career, you say you didn't have a business plan. Is that something, would you have gone back and maybe figured that out?
I mean, that's definitely a piece of advice I've given other people, whether I actually would have done it. There are sometimes I think, you know, actually I worked in some restaurants after Cajun College, just briefly really as stages. But because I felt I was already older than most people starting out and I didn't necessarily want to be a restaurant chef, I didn't carry on with that. And there were times when I thought maybe actually I should have worked for 2 or 3 years as a restaurant chef, but I was probably felt I was in a rush to go somewhere that I didn't know where I wanted that to be.
Yeah.
So I didn't. And then there were times when I think, well, maybe I shouldn't have carried on writing a website. I should have done that serious thing and started a business. But then, you know, things happen and I don't have too many complaints about what.
No, at the moment. No, you can't regret the website. The website's amazing. Let's move on to the fourth desert island dish, and that's your favorite sandwich.
I'm going to give another non-straight answer to this, if that's okay, because I think all sandwiches are good.
I concur.
So long as they're made freshly and with love. We're using good bread, and that doesn't need to be sourdough. It could be focaccia, or it could be just really nice, fresh sandwich loaf. But I don't know. Have you seen the film Chef?
Yes.
And there's a moment in there where he makes a cheese toastie.
Oh, yes.
Which takes about 4 or 5 minutes. And it's, you know, really, really kind of considered grilling of a cheese sandwich. And then he gives it to his son, who just like takes a bite and doesn't care. And but I really identify with that moment, not with the son not caring, but with taking the time over making the sandwich. And I think that's the kind of thing I want. And the sandwich has got to have a flavor that goes beyond the bread and lasts. So whether it's a really strong cheddar or a really strong ham or something fishy, but also something crunchy and something acidic. And, you know, I'm pretty happy to have quite a lot of sandwiches, but if those elements, good bread, good like key filling, and then something piquant and crunchy in it, then that's a good sandwich.
Yeah, that sounds good. If you were at a motorway service station,
and you had to
get a sandwich, what kind of shop?
Well, if I was at a motorway service station, then the options are limited, and I would go for the simplest thing.
Okay.
So like a ham and cheese.
Okay.
You know, you can't really go badly wrong with that, and probably buy a bag of crisps.
Okay.
So to put in there as well.
These are the questions. So
just to be clear, the crisps go in the sandwich.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm very much in favor.
Because you want to get the crunch, and then maybe there'd be salt and vinegar, perhaps, or, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that is a good way to jazz up a supermarket sandwich.
It's the only way.
So now I wanted to ask you about the supplemental feature on your blog, which you touched on briefly earlier, but it's something that really has helped you to gain recognition and stand out from the crowd. Tell us a bit more about what it is for anyone who may not know.
Okay, so supplemental is an element of my blog, which until recently I posted every Monday a roundup of the recipes in the weekend newspapers. In the last year I've had a baby and wrote the Borough Market Cookbook, and I found it a little bit harder to do it every week.
Yeah, that's understandable.
I'm doing it at least monthly at the moment. And you're right, definitely the website Rocket and Squash was well known and received before I started doing this. But in terms of, you mentioned, what would you do differently, or what if I told other people? The problem with my website is that it covers lots and lots of bases, and there's not necessarily one specialism. And I think that supplemental became a thing that it was known for because no one else was doing it. And it's a useful tool for people who love recipes to see that four or five newspapers are distilled, and all their supplements over the weekend are distilled into one page where they can click on through to the recipes that sound interesting to them. I'm not always complimentary, although generally I am.
Generally you are.
Yeah, I prefer to see the positives and things.
Yeah.
it's basically became a nice sort of review of things for people to click through.
It's such a useful thing because, yeah, unless you sort of subscribe to all the papers, it's hard to see all of those recipes.
Well, I mean, having not done it, now I don't do it every weekend. I now see how many things when I then round, you know, sum it all up and 3 or 4 weeks later, there's a lot that you miss. And it's, on the one hand, the papers were never originally designed for you to see every single thing. They only want you to be...
interesting.
The Telegraph would only ever want Telegraph readers to read their stuff, and it wouldn't matter that the week later someone else would do the same sort of recipe. But in the age of the internet, things changed a bit, and
can't get away with
we all click through to lots of things. Yeah, it's just been useful for people to look at. I think I've enjoyed doing it as well.
I'm guessing when you started doing it, I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but maybe you weren't fully aware of quite how big an undertaking you were taking on.
Actually, the first 4 times I did it, I did it for a different, like an app that wanted to create content.
Okay.
So I was paid for the first time, 4 times I did it. So that was fine.
Yep.
And then they actually folded, probably because they paid me. And I just thought, actually, this is quite a good idea. And it probably extended itself over time. It's actually gone up and down in size. For the first few years, the Independent on Sunday had a bigger food outlet than they do now. And different papers sort of changed their food content, or have changed their food content quite a bit over the last 4 years. So it's not at its most arduous at the moment.
Okay, and it's a really unique thing. I don't know if anyone else is doing that kind of thing, but I guess it gives you quite a unique insight into food trends and what's happening.
I'm sure that over the last, I think I've done it for 4 years, maybe more. It's given me definitely an oversight of not just the food that the newspaper supplements writers are generating and thinking about, and maybe you can see if they read each other's stuff and it affects that, but also quite a lot of the content in papers at the moment is cookbook material, so yes, extracts from cookbooks, and then also chefs trying to get press, so their PRs will offer extracts of their recipes to the papers as well. So you do really get quite a glimpse at what the trendsetters and or the sort of first followers of trends are doing. I don't know what that makes me and whether how much that has affected what I cook. There's never a week that I don't see something that I think that's a great combination of flavors, or that's a technique I haven't thought about, or that's a niche area of, you know, Italian or Mongolian food that I've never learned about, and that's really great. It's come to my mind and come to my attention. And so for me as a personal thing, that's been the benefit of doing supplemental, is that I'm sure opened my kind of horizons or reading of different foods, and it's good for inspiration in that
respect. Yeah, so good to find it personally inspiring, because then those are always the things that then ultimately inspire other people.
Yeah.
The weekend supplements, and I guess recipes in general, I feel like we're living in an age of, I don't know, I guess food porn. And I wonder how many people read those recipes and then actually go home and cook them.
I don't know anyone who's done the actual statistical analysis
study, wouldn't
of
it.
Well, yeah, it would either be good or depressing.
Yeah.
but it's, I think more people cook from supplement, like the weekend supplements, than you might think.
Okay.
I suspect actually more people cook from the weekend papers than they do from cookbooks.
Yeah, that's true. I asked that because a while ago I came across something that Nicola Humble wrote in her book Culinary Pleasures, where she told a story of how some publishers put out a recipe which extraordinarily used a combination of flavors when used together were poisonous. And so they completely panicked, recalled, you know, as many copies as they could, but there were copies out there that they couldn't do anything about. So they kind of just sat by the phone waiting for, I guess, dead bodies to arrive, and no one rang, no one died. And so no one had cooked from it, which I thought was really interesting. Kind of the second worst scenario.
I think that, you know, we all know that as a whole, the population of Britain certainly tends towards convenience, and whether that's picking up a convenience meal or doing something that they make all the time. And I, you know, I do that as well. Whenever I finish a cookbook, I spend 2 weeks having jack potato and cheese or spaghetti bolognese, or just stuff that's really like, it goes right back to your roots of not trying. And that's what most people do. Although everyone's time pressed, but there's still people who use the cookbooks for whether they're learning, whether they just want a bit of inspiration, and the ditto, the weekend stuff that I think it might be a very small niche of people that really pays attention to it and then cooks. But even those people that don't do it very often will accidentally, if they're Googling a recipe or if they're just want something, inspiration for friends coming over for the next weekend, the chances are that the supplement they saw 1 or 2 weeks ago might be the thing that comes to mind and they cook from that.
Yeah, it's very true. And that brings us on very neatly to the fifth desert island dish, and that's the dish you eat the most often.
I think that most often my fallback food here is, I don't sit at the on a Sunday and read through the recipes that I've read through and think I'm going to cook this on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. I think because I'm living in a part of London where I can pop out the door to get groceries in a couple of seconds, or I will be recipe testing stuff in a week that I don't want to think about, I often have leftovers. So the nights when I haven't thought about what I'm cooking, which must be at least 2 times a week, is so often I have a sort of a version of a carbonara.
When you say version?
Well, because I'm very conscious that the Italian cooks would not call what I call these things carbonara. So they might be, instead of bacon, it's wilted greens, or it's often leftover greens, whether it's part of a broccoli or roasted cauliflower leaves. But essentially the base is egg yolk, parmesan, and some garlic.
You can't go wrong with that.
Do you know what? I just said garlic. I'm not even sure garlic's supposed to be in carbonara. So that's the classic thing. It wouldn't be. It's definitely not guanciale, isn't it?
I think traditionally it's the flavor of garlic, but not the garlic.
Right?
Yeah. So you sort of take the garlic out, but you leave the flavor.
Wow.
I don't know.
but yeah. So it's whatever pasta shapes left and whatever things go to bulk out, which might be a form of pork product, but is often not.
That sounds like a very good option. Let's talk about your books. Your latest book, The Borough Market Cookbook. I mean, I learned so much. I feel really ignorant because I didn't know that Borough Market is over 1,000 years old.
No, it is quite an amazing story that that has always been a market on that kind of space next to the London Bridge for over 1,000 years now. And it's obviously changed quite a lot in that time, but they can trace things back to then, and I think there was a bridge at that time. I can't remember, so that must have been a reason why the produce came to that part of town. Or probably wasn't a town 1,000 years ago, was it? But then there were other things. So, like in the 18th century, the Parliament ordained, is that the right word? My legal training is completely gone. decreed that there was an act of Parliament that meant that there always has to be a market in Borough Market space now for the community, for the benefit of the community.
How great is that?
Well, it is great. And I think it's something that the charitable trust that runs Borough Market has taken a responsibility of really well, particularly in the last sort of 20 years as it's moved from being a wholesale space to retail, that not only is the outstanding produce there and a community of traders that bring amazing things to us that we can access very easily, but they're really quite big on community stuff. There's constantly community events, whether it's weekly demonstration kitchen stuff that people can just go to and see for free. There are kids that come and learn how to be market stall traders. They even grow, there's a various schools in the area grow produce and then once every few months come and sell it on a lunchtime.
That's
and
everybody's cool.
Like sort of 7-year-olds sort of shouting you to buy,
oh my God,
buy their pumpkins and try and undersell each other. It's quite fun.
That's adorable.
So they really, and that's just a snapshot of some of the community things that happen there. But part of the reason for that is that it's ordained that they have to run a market there for the benefit of the community.
That's so interesting. And there are 12 million visitors every year.
I think it might be 16 million. I don't know.
Ed, you wrote in the book it was 12.
Did I? that might be one of the essays that wasn't written by me. But anyway, the point there is that there are lots of people that come through Borough Market every year, and that's
it's a lot. It's
undisputable. It's a proper marketplace. You know, it's a meeting place for people.
Yeah.
And produce.
Yeah. And the book is a real triumph. It's got recipes and inspiration, but it also tells a really lovely story throughout the year. It's not a typical recipe book, but it must have taken a lot of work and a lot of time to put together. How long did it take you?
I've been writing for Borough Market for the last 6 years. It was my first, I think, ever professional commission as a food writer was from Borough Market for their website, and then subsequently their magazine called Market Life, which is great. And it's my most regular thing too. So the book took me a period of time in 2017, but I've been in and around the market constantly for a long time, well, 6 years, constantly meeting the traders and writing about produce and writing recipes that kind of meet the values of Borough and seasonal cooking and seasonal market shopping. So yeah, it took a certain amount of time, but I've probably invested quite a lot of other time in the place as well.
Yeah, in a way it's sort of been mulling over
longer
than when you actually wrote it. We're on to the sixth desert island dish, and that's your go-to dinner party dish.
Unfortunately, because I now do so much recipe testing and recipe development, I don't get to cook the same one thing all the time.
Yeah.
So my actual go-to dinner party dish is the dish that I'm supposed to be testing that week for people or for whatever cookbook. So actually last year in particular, lots of people got to taste the stuff that was coming in the Borough book, which was good for them and good for me.
Now, has that ever gone wrong? Because idea of recipe testing is presumably that sometimes, you know, it might not work exactly as you want. So has anyone ever had to eat sort of a Bridget Jones blue soup situation?
I don't think there's ever been anything quite as bad as Bridget's cooking, although she's she lives at Borough Market, doesn't she?
Well, exactly. It was a very good reference.
Friend of the market. interestingly, I did, there's a recipe in the book, which I think is a really nice autumnal one for malfatti, which means badly shapen. It's the kind of pastaless ricotta pasta.
Oh yeah,
a bit like nudie.
Okay, yeah, nudie.
But the name malfatti means badly shapen, so you don't have to make them look good.
Ideal.
However, and that's with wild mushrooms and brown butter and sage. It's really nice. When I did those for the first time, I think I might have tested three different versions on the same night for a writer called Ollie Hercules.
Oh yeah,
and now husband Joe, who photographed my first book, and Ollie's son Sasha. And Sasha was about six, I think, and didn't like the food.
Oh, no.
I don't think they were the best versions of that, of malfatti either. Also, and they're also just a bit big. Like, I didn't shape them, shape them badly, but they're also too big.
But children are not shy about telling
them. No, so it was a little bit of a, that's probably one of my least good entertaining evenings for a while, actually. Which, so yeah, I guess that's the answer, is that things don't always go right when you're testing.
Yeah, that's true. But I'm sure they've been way more delicious.
Well, they're better now as a result.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's the whole idea, isn't it? So we have a cookbook corner on Desert Island Dishes where we like to find out the guests' most treasured cookbook.
Yeah.
So I wondered what your most beloved cookbook was.
I think that my most beloved cookbook is a book called Week In, Week Out by Simon Hopkinson, who is often cited as his book, Roast Chicken and Other Stories.
Yes.
At some point was named the best cookery book of all time. And I think that as a result is often in lists by people. And it's really lovely. And he's an amazing writer and a brilliant recipe writer. But his book Week In, Week Out is a selection of his recipes and columns when he was the Independence Weekend, I think it was probably the Saturday writer. So it almost feeds into my supplemental kind of
strategy.
It's got nice long introductions to the food. And then three dishes each time. So it's exactly like newspaper columns are. And what's amazing about it is that it's a really nice mix of, he's like French trained kind of stuff. Him and Jeremy Lee and Roly Lee and stuff like that were big chefs in late 90s, I guess, and early 2000s of turning food into London into a good thing. So he's got that kind of classic French bit, but there's also very eclectic global things there. And I think the best thing about Week In, Week Out is that it's from a recipe comes from, there must be at least 15 years ago, might be 20 years ago, but if most of those recipes could still be published right now. And they are definitely things that I would, if I didn't have to ever make a recipe myself ever again, and I could just cook from a cookbook, I would turn to that more often than any other.
Wow. What a recommendation.
I actually think there might be, and this is not a plug and no one's asked me to do it, but I think they might be reprinting it this year or next year and republishing it.
Oh, great.
It's super good.
Okay. Need to get my hands on that. We're on to the final desert island dish of the day, and that's the last dish you would choose to eat before being cast off to the desert island.
Can I give another non-straight answer?
I'm very lenient.
Can it be a last meal?
Yes, of course. Yeah.
So I would start with, I know it's a desert island, so the sea is there.
Yeah.
But there are a particular type of anchovies that I would really miss.
Okay.
Called the Calabrian anchovies called Dombacate. If you ever you see really expensive anchovies on a menu, possibly those.
Okay.
And just with some really good bread and some sherry. And then I would have, again, fishy thing, but you know, Carabineros, the very red prawns. There's a place in Portugal, in Lisbon, called Cerveteria. That's not how you say it, Cerveteria. Ramiro. And he's got these amazing red prawns just cooked on a plancha with loads of salt, and you suck out all the juice from the head, and they're delicious. I'd then probably have a good piece of aged beef cooked nicely. Beef isn't my favorite meat, but I think that, I think if I'm going onto an island, I might miss it.
Yeah.
With tomato tonato.
Yes.
Good, really good leaves from a nice, you know, lots of tasty different leaves that taste of you know, something would be lemony like sorrel, and there'd be some mustard leaves and other bits in there, and maybe some potatoes. I'd have a cheese course.
I'm loving the sound of this.
I'd have comté, some aged comté with Vangin. Vangin, how do you say that? Which is that kind of fortified wine from the Jura, which is probably the greatest pairing in all of food and wine.
That's a big claim.
It's amazing. If you ever get the chance to have really good aged comté and Vangin, you've got to take it.
Okay.
And then I would finish with a very small, thin slice of a dark bitter chocolate tart and have a coffee with it as well.
Wow, that sounds amazing. I'm definitely going to be joining you. Thank you so much for letting us hear your desert island dishes.
Thanks for having me.
Anyone who enjoys a crisp sandwich is someone who's a good egg in my book. Here ends another delicious day of desert island dishes. If you're listening and you haven't yet left a review, now's your chance. Thank you so much for listening. Don't forget to go to the website desertislanddishes.co for the full list of episodes, plus the recipes I've created inspired by each episode. Loads more recipes, supermarket snoops, fridge files, it's all going on there. And do come over and say hi on Instagram. I'm Margie Nomura. And tell all your friends, the more the merrier. Thanks so much for listening, and see you next week. Bye.